Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we observe the 12th anniversary of the terrorist attack against the Twin Towers at New York's World Trade Center. Indelible images remain of that day, and certainly of its consequences. That's what we'll be talking about on today's program. Angelo Arzano is currently vice president and technical principal at HOK, the world-renowned architectural firm here. He was nearby during the 2001 New York attack against the Twin Towers, which his father helped build, by the way. He himself played a key role in implementing construction design of the new World Trade Center. We're also talking with Faizan Syed, Executive Director of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, about another aspect of the fallout from that day, how the Muslim community is faring 12 years after the attack. He is with me in studio. Also joining us by phone, psychologist Ron Scott, Training Council Coordinator of CARE and Counseling, to talk about coping with the ramifications of the attack. I thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Angelo, let me start with you. You were there. Give me, if you would, your recollection of that day.
Starting in sequence.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I was on my way into the office when the first plane hit. I was coming up in the elevator.
You're a few blocks away.
Office was right on the corner of Wall Street and Nassau, right by the Stock Exchange. So a block from Broadway, which is three blocks from the Trade Center site. So I was riding up in the elevator. I get into my office, and people are sort of looking around and asking each other, did you feel something, which I guess I didn't, must have been because I was in the elevator. Our office opened onto a back street, onto Pine Street, which was a narrow street. We saw papers fluttering down past the windows, which, you know, it was September. Come October, I think, you know, there's a lot of Yankees parades that go up and down Broadway every time they win a World Series. So it was sort of like that.
Enough of that in Cardinal territory.
It was sort of like that with just papers coming down. And we were sort of confused because nobody had heard about anything going on. And then we started to hear some rumors. I called my parents, who were out on Long Island, knowing that they would be up, and they flicked on the news, and at that time everyone was saying it was a small plane accident. Mm. A bunch of us went down to the corner of Wall Street and Broadway, where we had a clear view of the buildings, and we could see the hole in the smoke and just, you know, showering papers still coming down. I walked back up to the office to try to call my wife, and left some of my coworkers down there, and I think somewhat luckily for me, because shortly after that the second plane hit, and I know one of the women that I worked with she came back up just completely distraught, because she was staring up at the building when she saw the plane come in, saw the fireball, saw everything, furniture. You could tell from that distance that it was even people coming out of the other side of the building. So of course at that point everybody was sure it wasn't an accident. Trying to find out what's going on nobody has a radio at their desk, so everyone's trying to find out on the internet. Everyone's making phone calls trying to hear what's going on. I happen to have a meeting in Midtown, which I was definitely thinking was a good place to be rather than downtown at that time. So as everyone's milling around trying to figure out what's going on, hearing the reports, hearing rumors, there's another plane out there, nobody knows where it is, and as our office is right across from the Stock Exchange, after some time, the office decided, we don't know what's going on, we don't know if it's still safe, so let's close the office. So I went back down to my floor, myself and a friend of mine, we walked around the floor to try to tell other people that were down there, the office is closed, go home. Mm-hmm. Most people had already left on their own, at that point. And then, the two of us got on the phone. I got on the phone to call my wife and tell her that I was coming home. And my friend got on the phone to call his parents, who were in California, to just sort of let them know what was going on. And And I guess it was at that point that, you know, that was when the first tower came down. But, you know, when we were in that office space and all we could see looking out our window was another brick building 60 feet away. But we felt the vibration and even saw the glass on the windows, you know, vibrating back and forth. You know, and of course, it didn't help things. My friend standing behind me on the phone with his father goes, "That must be the third plane going after the stock exchange," which, you know, it wasn't. But, you know, we had no idea. And I was in the middle of talking to my wife when the phone went dead. So, of course, we just ran for the fire stairs and ran down. Luckily, we were only on the 9th floor. And we get to the bottom of the fire stairs, open up the door, and it's pitch black. And we're looking around at each other thinking, we must have gone too far and we wound up in the basement. And it turned out that we were on that back Pine Street, and it was just so much dust and debris that we couldn't see the sidewalk, let alone the buildings across the street. So at that point, a bunch of people were, you know, there were a lot of people gathering in the stair. Nobody was going out into that. And, you know, some people held open the door, and some of us were just, you know, yelling and grabbing people off the street to bring them into the stairwell because people were just wandering. People that had left their buildings earlier that were just caught on the street when the big dust clouds that I think everyone has seen just, you know, came through. You know, so then after that, we waited till things cleared a bit, and we headed east towards Brooklyn, towards the East River, and walked up that way. You know, and nobody knew what was going on. I remember walking past one street corner, and there was a fruit cart out there from a fruit vendor. Mm-hmm. And everything was just covered in this gray ash, so it almost looked like, you know, like some sort of a sculpture. You know, of course, the seller, he was gone. No one was bothering with the fruit. You know, and again, everyone's hearing rumors, and you know, it took me about 20 minutes to be able to get through on my cell phone to my wife to tell her that I was okay. And then, you know, we started to walk north. My friend happened to live in Midtown on 26th Street. And, you know, as we're walking up the streets, completely covered in ash, it was a hot day. At least for us, it was a hot day to be walking. You know, a couple of restaurants were open, and they were just letting people stop in and sit and get washed up and, you know, giving out water. You know, we made it to my friend's house, washed up a little bit more, and then went to a local pub where we all needed a drink. And got something to eat, and then saw it on TV, and which was an important moment, I think, for me on that time, because so many times you see these events happening in, you know, in London or in the Mideast or in Oklahoma City, and, you know, you see it on TV. Luckily, it happens more often on the TV than not for everybody. It was the first time that we could really see what had happened anyway, because we were so close to it. But it sort of put it in perspective a little bit, and actually made it real, because as we're walking up, we're hearing, you know, a plane hit the Pentagon, you know, planes hit the White House, you know, both towers fell down, and we're like, there's no way those towers fell down. And of course, we were completely wrong. You know, and then from there, it was just, you know, another long walk because the subways were closed, back to my house in Queens. And then as I was walking over the 59th Street Bridge, you know, people were stopping. I stopped. I turned around and, you know, looked back downtown, and, you know, there was just the plumes of smoke and nothing.
You became, in a sense, like the rest of us, just kind of watching it unfold. Yeah. from a distance. I have the sense, Angelo, listening to you talk, that it's maybe still difficult for you to talk about that. Am I wrong?
You know, I think, like, luckily in my life, I haven't had a lot of grief. You know, my parents are both still alive. My grandparents passed away when I was younger. So, you know, I imagine it's the same way everyone else is. And I guess we have a psychologist on the phone who can help. You know, that as you go through your daily life, you forget about it. You know, you remember it, you know. As I'm scheduling meetings, I'll see a date for September 11th and it comes back. But, you know, a lot of times you go on with your daily life and you don't just sit there and focus on it, especially 12 years later. But, you know, when people ask me about it and I go back and picture it in my mind and
Let's ask Ron Scott, who's joining us by phone, psychologist, about that. It is 12 years later, Ron, but perhaps you sense, as I did, that this is somewhat difficult to talk about 12 years later.
Well, it certainly would have been for me, and it did sound that way, Angelo, as well. I think it is the case that most people just go on with life, and unless something happens or an anniversary comes up, they may not really reconnect or remember the events. There are folks, however, who, for whatever reason, perhaps because they were more closer to the situation or more involved or had more anxiety going in, that can't get away that easily, that continue to be disturbed by memories and emotional and body memories as well as cognitive memories of the event, flashbacks and dreams. This is truly, even watching it on television, it was a traumatic event. Being in the middle of all of the dust and smoke makes it much more real and much more traumatic. The closer you are, I'm sure, the more that's the case. But, you know, what happens, I think, is that when events come along, like the theater massacre in Colorado or the Connecticut elementary school shooting, we end up with sort of spikes of anxiety and remembrance because of these kinds of events. My guess is that there's a sort of residual anxiety that most of us carry around these kind of events. We're more anxious, perhaps, in ways that we're not really aware of after 2011 than we were before. We're becoming a more anxious society, and that's affecting all of us because there is a cumulative effect, even if we're not directly aware of it and it's not impacting in a pathological way in our lives on a daily basis.
And, of course, a lot of dramatic things have happened since then directly related to that day, which just, I guess, exacerbates all of this.
Right, adds to it. I mean, it is cumulative. Yes, you're right.
Let me turn to FISA now. Before I take a break, I want to get your recollection. You're a young man. I mean, you're hardly a teenager, if a teenager, when all this happened. But what is your recollection of that day, and how did it impact you?
Well, on September the 11th, I remember it because I was in middle school at the time. And what happened is our teachers called us into the classrooms, and one of the teachers, he stood up and he said that something happened today, that the United States was attacked by an airplane, and they gave us a summary of what was going on. And then after that, they turned on the television, and once the television came on, that's when we were able to see it in reality. And I still remember that classroom, and I still remember that teacher, and I don't remember anything else about middle school except that. What happened next is that myself, along with this young generation of people, we grew up in a United States that was not defined, but it was changed by those attacks, whether it was with foreign policy or domestic policy. And even the work I do, a lot of it comes out of what happened that day and how people and Americans and others have responded to that day. And what we're hoping to do with the work that I do with CARE, and also as Americans, we should try to find ways on how we can understand that day and how we can sympathize with those people, and then also ensure that what caused that incident, what caused that event, that those factors dissipate over time rather than us being pushed into wars that continue and are perpetual. Rather, we try to find ways to limit down and to get rid of this anxiety that Mr. Ron spoke about that exists with all Americans today.
Directly impacting you as a Muslim, what sort of 12 years has it been in that regard?
As American Muslims, those attacks affected us greatly. First and foremost, we're, like any other people, very sympathetic, and I'm very happy that Mr. Angelo is here, and he gave us the eye account of what happened that day. Beyond that, we as a community have seen sort of the negative effects that can happen when you're blamed in part or partial for an attack that, of course, we had nothing to do with or we had no connection with. Since that time, we've seen decades-long wars occur in countries around the world. We've seen NSA spying on not only Muslim Americans, but actually all Americans across the United States. We've seen the United States engage in covert wars, you could call it, used through the use of drones in Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Algeria. We've seen laws come up, at least 134, according to Verdict magazine, in 15 months after September 11th, that's changed the landscape of how not only Americans look at themselves, but also how civil liberties is viewed. So all of these different factors has a very dramatic role, not only for American Muslims, but also for most Americans in general. And I think this negativity that exists is something that, as we remember what happened that day, we should take some time to realize what is going on and how can we change the situation rather than perpetuate that situation.
Well, we're already at the time for our first break. And when the Twin Towers fell on September 11, 62 members of Missouri's FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Task Force were called to help and flew to New York, where they spent the next 10 days searching the World Trade Center rubble. On the 10th anniversary of the attack, St. Louis Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra talked with some Maryland Heights firefighters who were part of that task force and recorded their memories of the days following 9/11. Throughout this program, you will hear firefighter paramedic Chris Moore, Assistant Chief Steve Reinhardt, Captain William Metzger, Captain Mark Stillpass, and Captain John Reith commenting.
It was the morning of the 12th when we left from New Jersey to head into Manhattan. It was my first trip to New York. I'd never been there before.
Coming across the bridge, you could see the smoke rising from what almost looked like a hole in the landscape of downtown New York, downtown Manhattan.
It was a pretty intense feeling, especially knowing what we were going there to do.
We were there several days before we were actually allowed to get in and start working. It was kind of a blur because when you first walk in and see the rubble pile.
There's really no training that prepares you for the initial impact of what you're going to see.
You know, each tower was 110 stories with about an acre per floor of concrete, whatever's in there, steel, glass, and all of it came down.
It was just 16 acres of crumbled steel, mangled steel. At certain areas, there was fires burning, so there was smoke coming out of certain parts of it. And then it sort of looked like anthills because there were so many rescuers, and a lot of them would be lined up in little lines, so they would carry buckets of debris, and it would just go from person to person to person.
I want to say probably a good 10 minutes. We just stood there and looked.
Hello again and welcome back as we continue our retrospective on this, the 12th anniversary of the attack against the World Trade Center in New York on 9/11, of course, 2001. We'll continue the conversation with Angelo Arzano, technical principal at HOK. He was in New York just a few blocks from where that attack took place. Faizan Syed is with us. He's executive director of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Joining us by phone is Ron Scott, a psychologist and training council coordinator with CARE and Counseling here in St. Louis. Before we continue that conversation, however, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following. A St. Louis City Commission, which oversees tax incentives, voted to approve the last two phases of the Northside Regeneration Project this morning. The approval includes more than $190 million in TIF funding for Paul McKee's project. Leaders in Belleville, Illinois, are seeking public input to develop the city's next comprehensive plan. The plan will include initiatives for improving housing, transit, and business development and is expected to go into effect next year. And Missouri's annual veto session began less than an hour ago. You can follow our live blog of what's happening. Visit stlpublicradio.org and join us this afternoon for complete coverage from our Statehouse reporter, Marshall Griffin, and political reporter, Chris McDaniel. Now back to our conversation relating to 9/11. Ron Scott, I'd just like you to comment on what we just heard from Faizan with regard to the anxieties that he and his community and so many of us have experienced since that day 12 years ago.
Well, I can really appreciate how anxious and uncomfortable that must be. You know, to think of yourself as an American and as a member of the American community, and then realize that you are being somehow singled out and marginalized or in completely rejected as a result of events over which you had no control and disagreed with, it has to be incredibly difficult. And I think that's something we have not been able to work through, or perhaps particularly well at all, or if at all. And of course, it's reinforced when there are events that remind people of some of the of the problems, such as the Boston Marathon event. Somehow or other, we are more reactive to events that are somehow defined as other people than we are to events from folks who we sort of define as our own. A Christian terrorist is somehow or other. There's simply not, we don't react to that as much as we do to an Islamic terrorist. And that's unfortunate, and we need to find some way to begin to move past that.
But, Ron, they say time heals all wounds, does it?
I don't know that it heals wounds. It tends to scab over wounds so that the damage may still be there and it may be very active, but you're not paying a lot of attention to it until something happens or an event comes up or something reminds you. But I don't know that time all by itself is necessarily you may be in less pain, but you may not really be any more healed.
Now, I've always heard that if you know someone who has gone through a traumatic event of some sort, be very careful in dealing with them in the situation on the anniversary of that event, because that, which we're doing today, of course, brings that back into focus.
Anniversaries are very powerful, and it's surprising how often people don't really recognize that, the anniversary of a death in the family, and they find themselves depressed, and they don't know why, because they haven't made the connection. And particularly an event like 9/11, because it is absolutely appropriate that we remind ourselves and commemorate it and talk about it, because you really don't want to forget. But it does have the effect of reminding people, and whether you're the trauma was more internal or more external, that is, whether you were in the actual situation or you were simply dealing with it in terms of your internal responses, that can be very powerful and unexpectedly powerful.
Let's turn back to Angelo Arzano now, who was in New York that day. Angelo, your father was an iron worker and helped in the construction of the Twin Towers. That must have made this whole episode even more disturbing for you.
At the time, it never even crossed my mind. It wasn't until I got involved in the reconstruction, and the work on Freedom Tower that came into play when, he could talk about his experiences on the original building. But at the time of the events,
What does he say about it?
About
its happening on something on which he had worked.
Nothing specific. I think as someone who, my father grew up in New York, and saw a lot of the city grow, I think he has, the buildings there have a special place for him because he can walk around the city and talk about the buildings that he worked on. I've worked on one or two, and I know just how proud I am to take a taxi ride past a building and look up at it and remember the work. So, he spent 35 years working on buildings in New York, that was one of them. And I think if that had happened to any of the buildings he worked on, he would have had a special connection to it.
I've always thought it must be very neat to be involved in construction of something like that and drive by and say, I helped do that. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about the work that you've done on, you referred to it as Freedom Tower. I think they've changed that designation now, haven't they? WTC.
One World Trade Center was a name that we had always used when we were working on it, to go along with the master plan. And Freedom Tower is a name that had come up through the governor at the time, but I think now that they have officially, a couple years ago, officially changed the name back to one WTC, one World Trade Center.
That's due to open officially sometime next year, if I understand it. But tell me about you're helping and implement the design, the technical architect, is that correct? So you help implement the design that somebody else created. But
correct.
What were the changes that have been rendered in this building as a result of 9/11?
There were many, that were taken from some standards that were already in place. Most building codes, most building construction is unfortunately trial and error. Especially when you get into complex designs, I think earthquakes is one that I hear about the most, where we keep thinking that we know what we're doing, and then another earthquake happens and we realize that we need to make a change, and then another earthquake happens. We spent a lot of time doing some investigations into some other codes. I know there were a lot of other agencies that were looking at the buildings themselves, the original towers, and trying to figure out what happened. It wasn't the impact from the planes that took them down. Was it the fire? Was it, was it a government plot? Was it a lot of other things? We just went back, and in the end, everything that went into the building was in hindsight common sense. The biggest thing being that the core of the building is made out of reinforced concrete, and that we put a lot of emphasis on protecting those items that were most critical. Knowing that nothing we can do to design a building could stop a plane from hitting it. But everything that we put into buildings is designed, and those buildings and, buildings in the past and buildings in the future, they're designed to mostly help mitigate an event that happens, whether it's a fire, whether it's a security breach. So the first emphasis that we put on was, along with structural reinforcement and structural hardening of the building, was to make sure that we can get people out as fast as possible, to protect the people that were in there on their way out. Look at some of the problems that the firefighters had at the event. Looking at the data on how people got out of the building, were there enough stairs? How can we make sure that if something like that happens in the middle of a building, the people above the event get out better? So, the center of the building is hardened and protected and reinforced. The stairs are hardened and protected. The stairs are oversized to just allow people to get out faster. There's separate set of stairs and elevators for the firefighters. One of the biggest problems they had with 9/11 was, if you can imagine, two stairwells and this stream of people trying to come down, and you've got a couple firefighters, not only carrying all their gear, but trying to run up 90 stories against a flow of traffic. So a lot of emphasis that we had gone went into how can we make sure that the responders can get there faster. It wasn't all breaking new ground. It was all things that had been thought about. Europe has had for years a requirement for having a firefighter's elevator to help firefighters get up into buildings. And it's a lot of common sense stuff that the building codes didn't quite address, or that for some reasons, a lot of it purely economics, that building owners haven't implemented. A building owner is not going to go out of their way to make their stairs a lot wider and take up a lot, cost them more money to build and lose money that they can rent the space out for. Mm-hmm. Certainly on that building, everybody was willing to make whatever accommodations it took to make it a better building. As a lot of these are now, a lot of the features that we put into place are becoming part of the building code. It's certainly going to make buildings going forward a lot better. I'm sure a lot of building developers that are out there, from the profit side, have a little bit more angst about spending additional dollars on things. But then the other side of it is there were plenty of developers that had gone the other direction because, they could charge more and they could get more people that wanted to move into a building where they could say, our building is a lot safer than that building next door.
But can you say with any degree of certainty that if an airplane, God forbid, should fly into this new building, that it would not suffer the same fate in terms of collapse, for instance, that the others did?
There are a lot of variables that would play into that. I could never make that statement. But what I could say is that should something happen again, you know, we've done everything we could to make sure that as many lives could be spared as possible.
Right. Let me turn back to you with regard to what you and your organization are doing most recently to try to counter some of that anxiety that you were talking about a little while ago, and also to make have a positive impact on this community.
Well, one thing that Mr. Ron said that is quite profound is he mentioned the Boston bombing. And recently we held a media press breakfast in order to give advice to members of the media on better ways to cover the Muslim community and other factors of this nature. One of the statements we told them and some advice is that whenever there's an attack done in the United States by a terrorist who happens to be Muslim, unfortunately, most of the coverage that's given is about their religious identity, and very rarely does one hear the reasoning behind it, the political reasoning behind why it happened. So, for example, the Boston bombing, one of the attackers, he said, and he quotes, that he was forced by U.S. foreign policy to attack Americans as he could not see, again, quote, such evil go unpunished. The 9/11 hijackers, they mentioned similar political concerns, such as the United States support of Israel and building of a military base in Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. What happens is that when a public witnesses such acts of horror done by these types of terrorists, and they're never given a deep insight into their political reasoning, whether we agree with it or don't. Of course, most of the time we disagree with it because much of it is insane. But when that's not discussed, then the only avenue for people to understand what happened is their religion, is their belief, is their faith, even though that's not what's driving them. And when that's what the public understands, that's when media, political figures understand as well, then they'll implement policies or the country will take a direction that makes the situation worse rather than trying to figure out exactly what's causing these types of attacks. Of course, as I mentioned, it's not justified what they're doing, but that needs to be emphasized as well. So that's part of what we're doing as an organization. Beyond that, we've witnessed in the most recent election, many of the possible presidential candidates were bringing up issues that they would not trust Muslims to be in their cabinets, or they wouldn't trust Muslims to be judges. And we're also seeing laws introduced into 38 states that would legally discriminate against religious minorities. Missouri is one of those that introduced these anti-religion laws, which is being actually on the veto floor today. So when you have this type of action being done by high-level officials, and when you have laws being introduced that will cause legal discrimination, then it creates not only in America that's bad for American Muslims that increases their anxiety, but it also creates a situation which is bad for all Americans when you legitimize ideas that really should be out there, but yet they become mainstream.
Well, we want to continue this conversation. You've just heard from Faizan Syed, Executive Director of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Ron Scott is joining us by phone. He's a psychologist and training council coordinator with CARE and Counseling here in St. Louis. Also with me in studio is Angelo Arzano. He's a technical principal and vice president at HOK here. He was in New York at the time of the 9/11 attack. Back to continue our conversation. If you'd like to come in and join it, do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Now we'll hear from more of those firefighters from Maryland Heights who were there right after the attack as part of a search and rescue mission.
There was a distinct foul odor to the air.
You had fuel burning, all the dust in the air. You could taste the concrete and the mortar in your mouth.
The smell that was picked up there was kind of an indescribable smell. I used to have a lot longer hair, and actually we couldn't get the smell out of our hair, so we all basically shaved our heads.
The smell, I mean, the smell of smoke, and then eventually you could smell people.
You know, as long as I had the respirator on, I didn't really notice the smell so much, but anytime you took it off, you immediately were hit with an odor that was, you know, it was, I mean, the odor of death, basically.
Hello again and welcome back. We continue our conversation, kind of a retrospective on this, the anniversary of the 9/11 attack in 2001. With me in studio, Angelo Arzano, technical principal and VP at HOK. Faizan Syed is with us. He's executive director of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Ron Scott, a psychologist and training council coordinator with CARE and Counseling here in St. Louis. He joins us by phone. Angelo, let me come back to you. Were you in New York during this flap about the Islamic Center, a couple of blocks from the...
I was.
Well, what are your thoughts about that, having listened to Faizan here?
You know, I mean, I think our country is founded on religious freedom, and, you know, the fact that people wanted to have a mosque close to the Trade Center, I don't see why that was an issue at all.
It certainly was. I mean, it certainly received a lot of attention. Ron Scott, back to you. In connection with this and some of the other things we've been talking about, how do you explain the way people are reacting? I mean, there's a xenophobia, I guess, if I can put it that way, with regard to people who are a little bit different. And I'm not talking only about Muslims, but I'm talking about so many of the different kinds of people we have. How do you explain the reaction to them?
Well, life is scary. As a generalized statement, I suppose. You know, I think much of the prejudices that people carry, a lot of them are learned. I mean, they're very much a part of their formative experiences. But I think they're often maintained and reinforced by the fact that just the process of living produces a lot of anxiety, and people need to find a way to function in spite of sometimes what would otherwise be kind of disabling anxiety. And one way to do that is to sort of separate life into the acceptable and the unacceptable, the safe and the unsafe, so that you have a sense of knowing, or at least thinking that you know, how to operate and keep yourself safer. And unfortunately, that often translates into particularly an other that's easily definable, whether it's by color of skin or by type of dress or accent or, you know, other kind of cues that make it possible for us to be able to say, okay, that's not a safe person. And it's obviously not based on any kind of useful information. It leaves us feeling a little more comfortable, at least the illusion of a little more comfort, when in fact it has nothing to do with the reason why we're anxious in the first place.
Faizan, do you see it that way?
Definitely. I think in the United States, there's a lot of discomfort and misinformation about Islam and American Muslims and just Muslims in general. Even your audience, if I was to ask a very rhetorical question, just as what is the most important belief in Islam? You know, what is the most important belief in Islam? I think many listeners would not be able to answer that question, that, you know, in Islam, the most important belief is that to believe in one God alone, that he has no partners, sons, or daughters, and to focus your worship on him. And I think many people, they understand Islam as a political reality. They were introduced to Islam on September 11th in Iraq and Afghanistan in all these very unique ways, and they've never looked at Islam as a religion, as a way of life where people truly, sincerely worship the divine in a way that's profound. If you knew somebody who prayed, let's say, five times a day, if nothing else, you would at least think that person is trying to build a relationship with his Lord. If you knew somebody who fasted 30 days out of the month, out of the year, as Muslims do in Ramadan, you would think that person is trying to better themselves, better their lives, be in control of their desires rather than their desires controlling them. And if you knew people of this nature, then perhaps you'd have a different view. But I think the way Islam and Muslims are brought up and understood by most Americans is in this political misreality, perhaps. And when that religious aspect is not in the conversation, then you're only looking at a people as them versus us, as those people or us here. And you're not looking at sort of what is a Muslim itself. So part of the work we try to do is try to educate people on Islam and Muslims and try to also make them realize it's not just a political issue. It's actually more of a, not a religious issue, but something that requires religious understanding.
Right. Angelo, do you have children?
I do.
Yeah. How do you talk to them about this sort of thing?
You know, we haven't really, my daughter's only nine. You know, we've talked to her briefly, in sort of round images of, you know, that this was an event that had happened at one time. Without getting too graphic, without getting too political about it. Similarly, when the shootings at the school in Connecticut happened, and for that one, that actually happened to be about 5 miles from her school. Where she was very upset that her spelling test got interrupted because of it. But, you know, at one thing that was interesting for us as parents at that time was that to see how different parents were handling it. Because, you know, I happened to be here at the time already. My wife and daughter were still back in Connecticut. And my wife sat down and explained to her, to my daughter what had happened as best we knew it. There were some parents that, you know, that we know that just didn't mention it at all, mm-hmm. Pretended it never happened.
Ron Scott, how should parents deal with such things?
Well, it's not an easy decision to make. You certainly don't help your child by hiding the world from them. But at the same time, your children, and particularly when they're in younger years, they need to at least have a sense and understanding that you may be open with them, but that they're also safe, and that, to the extent that you can assure that. So terrifying your children in order to get them to be more obedient is hardly a solution. Hiding a reality from them really isn't either. There needs to be a way of talking with them that provides some measure of assurance and security that, you as a parent or parents are doing everything you can to assure that your family is safe. And as they can incorporate more, particularly as they move into adolescence, then it's possible to talk in a little more complexity and a little more layers because they're capable of understanding things at a little more complex level.
I wonder, Ron, how people can expect to be affected. People who are there, people who were close to this situation 12 years ago, they're going to be watching on television tonight. There's certainly going to be some repetition of some of those videos that we're all so familiar with. Reacting to that, how they're likely to react, how they should react, or whether they should just take themselves out of the mix and not watch this stuff.
Well, I'm not sure there's a should, because I think different people will react differently. If I were one of those folks and I suddenly found myself in tears, I don't think I should be surprised. So if I'm uncomfortable with doing that in public, I might want to watch those events if I watch them in the privacy of my home. I think that it's almost inevitable that those powerful images and memories are going to be recalled. Those things don't go away. If I feel overwhelmingly distressed or disturbed by that, and I feel less able to function, then I probably need to think about looking for some professional help to try to find a way, whether that's a group or a counselor or a psychologist, to find a way to begin to talk through the events. Because what ultimately we have to be able to do is remember but understand events in a different way than we understood them when they were happening and immediately afterwards. That reprocessing, whether it's done with some kind of behavioral treatment technique or whether it's done through just an opportunity to continue to talk about things enough so that you're not so anxious that you can't really think about them anymore. That's the way we reprocess and understand ourselves and the events differently.
Angelo, will you be watching television tonight and watching those pictures?
Actually, I have a deadline at the end of the week, so I'll be working tonight.
Uh-huh. But if you didn't have that deadline.
In general, I wouldn't be going out of my way to watch any of the events. I think I've seen enough. I think there were certainly a lot of heroes from that day. I don't need to watch the news or watch a movie or, you know, or do something about these events to remember it.
When you were talking about redesigning or designing the new building and talking about making the wider staircases so people could get out more easily and first responders could come in, I just have that vivid memory of all the discussion about the firefighters running in while everybody was running out. I mean, that really says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did it change your life, or did it, that day?
When it gets down to the root of things, you know, the day-to-day, it didn't change. I mean, I didn't – there were little things. You know, certainly there were times when I would avoid mass transit. You know, our office was closed for a full week, and then the first week that the office was open right after that, you know, we couldn't get off at the normal subway stop. We had to get off a couple blocks away and walk past and see the shards of some of the towers that were still up, you know, walking past, you know, armed National Guardsmen to allow us to get into our building. You know, I mean, so certainly there were things that changed. But in the long term, it hasn't really changed what I do on my day-to-day life.
Yeah. Fine. How about you? We've talked about some of the things that have changed for you as a group, as a collective, but what changed in your life most dramatically, do you think, as a result of that day?
Most dramatically, after those attacks, I found myself becoming an ambassador for Islam everywhere I went. Many people, you know, you always can't look at me, but I'm obviously like brown in complexion. I have a big beard as well. So when people look
very,
at me...
Very handsome young man.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I'm sure my wife would agree. So everywhere I'd go, you change the way you look at yourself. You change the way your community interacts with the larger society. You become an ambassador to people who may not necessarily know. You become somebody who has to be an expert on issues at a very young age. And this really affected me from that time till this very day, and affected many American Muslims to this day as well, how we are perceived. Also, I'm about to get married in October, and September 11th affected the way I grew up since then. But I hope that that day does not affect my children when I have them in the future, and I hope they're not defined by that same tragedy or that same event, and they can create a new world that they can be a part of and they have a hand in.
The time is getting away from us, and I do want to give you an opportunity to tell folks about what you're up to today with regard to your special event.
So tonight is our 9/11 day of service. September 11th is called Patriot Day, and it's a national day where men, women, children are all encouraged to give back to their communities. So this evening from 4 p.m. till 7:30, we're meeting at Yeatman Market, which is located at 4401 Atheline Avenue in St. Louis. And we'll be doing a neighborhood cleanup project, us with Veterans for Peace Project Downtown, which is a Feed the Hungry program, interfaith partners as well. And the idea is that we remember September 11th as a tragedy, but we want to give back to the community. It's a day of service, a day of remembering through service. And this is how we as people of faith and we as people of conscience, we would like to give back. And of course, we encourage everybody who's listening, if you're available at 4 o'clock, to come on by and you can help in the neighborhood project as well.
We'll get some of that information on our website in time, I think, perhaps, mm-hmm. to have them help during the course of the day. Yeah. Final thought, Angelo, you'd like to add in 10 or 15 seconds? Not really.
No.
You'll be glad when this day is over, I suspect. Ron, how about you? You've got 15 seconds for a final thought, if you have one.
Well, let me pick up on Faison's suggestion about the day of service. I think that is a way we can begin to incorporate and maintain the lessons from 9/11 while making them positive and helping people feel as though they're constructive and contributing. So I'd really like to encourage people to pay attention to those opportunities and to build on them.
Ron Scott, thank you so much. Ron is a psychologist and training program coordinator. I think I said something else earlier. Training program coordinator with Care and Counseling. Angelo Arzano was a technical principal with HOK and vice president. Faison Syed, director of care. Thank you all so much for being with us and sharing your thoughts on this day. We'll hear more from those firefighters from Maryland Heights in just a moment. But tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at how the overconsumption of goods and services adversely affects the environment and efforts to counter those effects. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.
The guys that I was privileged to respond with, did their duty up there that day, or those days. And I think they can all be proud of what they did.
Someone said, though, that even though we couldn't rescue anybody, we helped rescue the spirits of people, the loved ones, to bring them closure.
One of the coolest things I remember was coming home.
They lined the highways up for us when we came back. There were flags everywhere.
I live in Eureka. It's a small town. I grew up there. And when we got into town, they stopped us. They put us on trucks. And it was basically like a parade through town. You know, it was 10 o'clock at night, and there was thousands of people out there because we were coming home.